Hi, I'm Dan.
And I'm JJ.
And welcome to The Men Who Explain Miracles. Hello, and welcome back to The Men Who Explain Miracles. I'm Dan, and in this episode, I have the honour and pleasure of interviewing my co-host, JJ. I'm going to be talking to JJ about his work in bringing back an out-of-print classic of the Golden Age of Detection, Murder on the Way by Theodore Roscoe. I'm going to be asking how he managed to get such a forgotten book back into the hands of readers, and why so many classics of the Golden Age of Detection are forgotten or left behind. So, welcome JJ, it's nice to have you.
Thank you very much, nice to be here.
You, of course, write at the popular blog, The Invisible Event.
It's very kind of you to call it a popular blog.
I definitely think it is. Well, at least I visited it. That's one person,
that's,
isn't it?
Just two of us, yeah.
Yeah, are all the hits from you, maybe. Really.
I think so. I mean, it's just me just reloading the page at work, yeah.
From different people's computers, yeah. Great, bringing up the stats. And you are now somewhat of an editor and proofreader in that you have brought a number of different Golden Age detection books back to life, back from the dead, back into readers' hands. So tell us a little bit about Murder on the Way by Theodore Roscoe from 1935 for listeners who may not have come across Roscoe before and may not have come across this book.
Sure. Roscoe was primarily a writer for a lot of different pulp magazines in the US in the early 1930s. And Murder on the Way is essentially understood to have come out of a trip that he took to Haiti. He travelled a lot. He wrote to support his travelling, and he also travelled to inform his writing. And I mean, it's typically seen that he was in Haiti 1933 or 1934, and then on the back of that wrote a six-part serial called A Grave Must Be Deep, which revolves around a lot of the voodoo religion and superstitions that he would have encountered in Haiti. And this was re-edited. The characters were changed around a bit. Some of the events were changed. It was eventually kind of republished as a novel in its own right in 1935 under the title Murder on the Way.
And why did you take on the task of trying to bring this forgotten Golden Age locked room classic back into print? And why this book in particular, among any others?
We are currently in a very lucky position as fans of GAD. There's a huge amount of reprints happening. You know, the British Library is doing a huge amount. You've got Dean Street Press, who are producing a lot of stuff. There are so many publishers producing a lot of stuff, but there's still so many things that remain out of print. And it's that eternal frustration of trying to find a decent copy of, I don't know, Christiana Brand's Death of Jezebel or something like that.
Yeah.
And primarily it was curiosity to see if it would be possible to bring something that people would be excited to read back. And I mean, Murder on the Way is a book that among impossible crime fans enjoys a fantastic reputation. But it just was not available. There was no copy of Murder on the Way in the British Library, for instance. And I mean, they have 26 billion books or whatever.
Wow,
it is.
Wow, that's amazing.
They do have a copy of the original serialization,
okay,
which was published independently. So they have a copy of A Grave Must Be Deep, but they don't have Murder on the Way. And in fact, I don't think there was, at the time, I believe I'm right in saying, I don't think there was any library, either private or public or academic, anywhere in the UK that had a copy of Murder on the Way.
Wow.
And for a book that enjoys such a fantastic reputation, quite deservedly, I was just really curious to see, you know, the fact that it's gone so out of print, could it be brought back, and how could that be achieved?
So let's get into discussing the book itself, Murder on the Way by Theodore Roscoe. Murder on the Way is an absolute whirlwind of a story, and I just love that whole arcing plot narrative. Could you explain a little bit more about that for us?
Essentially, it is narrated by an artist, a guy called Edwin Cartershall, who is painting in his studio. He's in his studio with his... Well, she's not technically his girlfriend, but she's technically his girlfriend.
It's complicated.
It is. The Facebook relationship status for this relationship probably doesn't exist. And a lawyer appears in the office, an emissary from an elderly relative of hers, of Pete, Patricia Dale, who goes by Pete, to effectively tell her that her uncle has died, and she is mentioned in the will. The uncle lived in Haiti, and they travel to Haiti for the reading of the will and the funeral, which had taken place on the same evening. The will is essentially, it's a slight variation on a tontine, whereby everything Eli Proudfoot owned is left to one person under particular circumstances. If that person fails to fulfill those circumstances, they're left to the second person on the list. If they fail to do it, they're left to a third person on the list, and it goes down through eight people, Patricia being the eighth. They have 24 hours on Haiti, effectively, to get him buried and to remain on the island. And pretty quickly, what starts happening is that the first person on the list fails to meet those requirements because they are murdered. The second person on the list is then murdered. And steadily, bit by bit, people are being taken out one by one.
And almost all of them in impossible or supernatural circumstances. And yeah, the thrilling pace of each person being picked off and this the intensity of the 24-hour period, the claustrophobia of that location.
Yeah, I mean, once it starts, it really does not let up. I think you've got sort of two chapters of getting everybody in place. And from chapter three onwards, it's just insane. It's wonderful.
100 miles an hour.
Oh, crazy. Yeah, absolutely crazy.
Which brings me on to another thought, actually, quite nicely, in that, as you mentioned at the start and you wrote in your introduction, that Roscoe started out in the pulps, as did this book, in a serialized form. How do you think, having read both the serialized form and the final novel and having edited it, how do you feel that influenced the pace of the writing, the style of the writing, and the form of the story itself?
I mean, I'd say at the very start of my introduction, I think the pulps were an incredible proving ground for a lot of writers, you know, because there was this tremendous pressure to produce something on a regular basis, and if what you wrote wasn't good enough, there are however many hundreds of people clamoring to take your place in however many hundreds of magazines. And so there's a definite need to have a really propulsive narrative. But inside of that, like, I think these wonderful turns of phrase come out, like this very arresting use of language. So it's not just that stuff is happening quickly, it's that stuff is happening quickly and in a very interesting sort of phrasing and very interesting passing. Like, Roscoe has this wonderful sort of ability with descriptive prose. There's a fantastic line early on, which is one of my favourite in the book, where he says something along the lines of, the room was as miserable as the peeling wallpaper in a Russian novel. And you've just got these lovely sort of absurdities where there's this very wry sort of perspective on this frankly insane series of events. And I think what the pulps really encouraged, that the fact that you are trying to push something along really quickly, but also you have to be able to resolve it quite quickly. Like, the resolutions, when they come, everything just kind of spirals and spirals and spirals, and then suddenly you've got the answer. And it's not that it's a rushed answer, it covers everything, and it covers it in an appropriate amount of depth. But I think, like we saw with one of our previous books on this, Rim of the Pit by Haig Talbot, there's just this at the end, it's just like, oh, and then here's where everything was done. And there's this massive explanation that, again, you're just like, oh God, yeah, that was the point all along. And I think the pulps really encourage that, because, again, you've got to have, you know, you're publishing one episode a week for 6 weeks, and then suddenly it's all got to be kind of wound up very tightly, so you can't have too many lingering threads. And I think that really carries through with this. It's a really tight piece of plotting.
The characters in the book are diverse racially, but also they're diverse in themselves as well. We don't get a set of people that you can't tell between. They're so different to one another. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing, and again, I'm sorry, I'm going to keep referring back to my introduction, but in the introduction, I liken them to Bond villains, because they are all these tremendous grotesques, these sort of beautifully larger than life portraits of just hideous human beings that Fleming absolutely excelled at. I mean, there are very few fictional bad guys, I think, quite so imprinted upon popular culture as much as the evil masterminds that Fleming came up with over the course of his Bond stories. And these really struck me as being in that kind of vein. You know, you've got none of them are presented sympathetically, but none of them are presented in a way that feels like it's sort of unfair pillory or deliberate nitpicking, or if there's any kind of racial, stereotypical, cultural ignorance on Roscoe's part. I think he was far too well-travelled a man. I think he'd encountered, you know, other cultures were not foreign to him. He did so much travelling. And I think, you know, he just captures these lovely sort of lightning in a bottle approaches. And again, I think that's something that comes out of the pulps, because you draw these very gaudy characters.
Yeah.
And then they stick in the mind. So a week later, when you pick it up to read the next installment, you're like, oh yeah, of course, that's the cackling guy who doesn't have a tongue, or that's the Nazi. And this is 1935, and they're already writing about Nazis in a very, very negative light. Mm. You know, to this sort of cultural awareness, this political awareness of what was happening in the wider world. I mean, it's not a political tract or treatise at all, but it is obviously an awareness of sort of what the Nazis represent. And it's just beautiful how you just have all these, it is a very rich palette. It's just all these different colours that just mix together incredibly and remain very distinct in the process, I think.
And I like the way that he uses it to bring satire on Western culture as well. And I remember there's a bit, I'll paraphrase here, but the head of the local police force says to Cardshaw, I've met many people like you who, you know, come to my country and they complain, or they say about how different we are without realising that you're the one who's the foreigner.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really, really interesting,
yeah,
the way he draws that out.
Yeah.
I'm also reminded in a kind of tangent, which is going to be a big tangent, but I'll make sense of it, of the clown school in France called Gollier, which is run by a clowning teacher called Philippe Gollier. And he said the thing with clowns is that they have to be balanced between charming and grotesque to be... you have sympathy for them in some sense, but also they're so disgusting to look at. But that abject quality to them draws you in. And even the way that the bodies of the people are described has that kind of abject, strange quality.
Yeah.
Then the thickening mud, the showers of rain everywhere happening all the time round the building, the way, as you said in a few words, he describes a scene so wonderfully. All of that leads to this kind of maddening, strange, clown-like claustrophobia, which again, as you say, really comes out of the pulp culture.
Yeah, I mean, so many of the characters press on each other all the time, so you feel like there's this weirdly kind of suffocating, it's very entertaining, but there's that weirdly suffocating element to how it evolves. You get that, there's that sort of "and then there were none"-esque element of, as people start to die, characters deliberately throwing accusations out at other people, sort of that, well, I know it's not me, so it's got to have been you, and I, you know, I suspect that it couldn't have been him, so it must be her. And there are these just lovely sort of in-character asides as they just react in complete panic to these probably very panic-inciting situations. But because they are such different characters, like one of them just goes and gets drunk, you know, like, because they are such different characters, they respond in so many different ways, and it keeps it very alive, and it keeps it very rich as a narrative experience, I suppose.
And I think that's a mark of a great golden age detective fiction writer, is that the characters are, they naturally lead to the forms of clues, the forms of ideas that you're getting. It's not that you have a cardboard cutout character and you just implant a clue in its mouth that doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Everything comes out of what they would do, even if it's trying to throw you as the reader off and plant blame on someone else.
Yeah.
Which leads to my next thought about this. which is that there isn't really a detective as such in this book, in that one person who is trying to guide us through the way. I guess through Pete and Cartchill, we get a sense that they are trying to work things out. But in a funny way, all of the characters are doing that, whether they're trying to put blame on someone else to save themselves or not, we don't know. How do you think that it changes the way that one might read this book?
I think it's one of those things where you are obviously going to speculate as a reader quite what's happening. And it's that very clever thing of trying to get the characters to speculate in a way that your reader is going to respond. And so you're trying to preempt and sort of usurp their expectations. And, you know, we've all read a book and at the 25% mark gone, oh, well, it's definitely been done like this. And then at the 50% mark, the writer has turned around and gone, ah, you probably thought it was done like that, and it wasn't. And you're like, oh, damn. The great thing about this is you've got it happening with five or six characters at once. I mean, the only nominal policeman, Nemo Narcisse, who's the head of the gendarmerie on Haiti, is this sort of... He's not clueless in the sense that he's that sort of comically bumbling thing, but he just sees this ridiculous insanity happening and just wants the quickest and easiest way to the heart of it. And so immediately, and again, there's kind of that inversion of the GAD stereotype where suspicion falls upon the foreigners. But in this case, the foreigners are the white American couple who have come to Haiti.
Great.
And so there are wonderful periods in it where he demands to Cartichaud, for instance, that he proves that he is an artist, that he hasn't just come under this sort of this disguise of being an artist. And so in the middle of this bloodbath, he's asking Cart to finish a painting that he's painting to prove that he actually is an artist. Mm. And so while you have a detective in the sense that there is a member of the police force and there are gendarmes, you know, who turn up in the plot, bloody everywhere. But I love the fact that you've just got all these different sort of investigative routes and solutions and interpretations coming in. Because the joy is, the hope is, that they're all going to be wrong, and he's still going to find a way to whip a rug out from underneath you, which I think he does. I think he whips about 8 rugs out from underneath you.
Yeah, yeah, you know. Absolutely. And again, it's a different reading experience in that sometimes you get one detective's way of thinking. So we get the kind of ratiocination that we'd expect from them. But with this, we've got so many different characters who are so diverse. Their ways of thinking are so diverse. And the type of deductions they make are very diverse. So you suddenly think, oh, I hadn't seen it from that angle before, because it naturally comes from that character's perspective.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the impossibilities. Again, it's a whirlwind of impossible situations. There's impossible shootings, floating guns, people being chased down corridors that disappear at the other end. And of course, the whole idea of people coming back from the dead, zombies walking around. And again, what I love about all these impossibilities, they're not just shootings in locked rooms, things like that. They flow naturally out of the claustrophobic context and of the context of the culture. So the impossibilities feel very unique, therefore.
I think the thing that I particularly like about this, and I think the thing for me that really marks this out, is it's not just that you have, like you say, an impossible shooting, a couple of impossible vanishings and various things like this. It's also that it's against this backdrop of a zombie uprising on Haiti in a place where the way Roscoe presents it, there is a tremendously rich seam of superstition. And I think that whole thing is handled incredibly well as well. Like, it's not just this lazy kind of, you know, stupid locals who are caught up in a, you know, in this lazy superstitious nonsense. Like, that whole background to it, the fact there's this massive rationality behind it, and then in the foreground you have more irrationalities and, you know, all these crazy things happening in a crazy setting filled with, as we've said, crazy people. Mm-hmm. And it's just these wonderful levels of garishness just kind of overlaid atop each other. And it all flows. It's all tremendously organic. And actually, when you get to it, the zombie uprising is incredibly intelligently explained. And the various impossibilities are incredibly intelligently explained. And it is just this brilliant tapestry that he's been constructing very deliberately around the culture that is also tremendously respectful of that culture. You know, like, there isn't a lazy condemnation of religion or of the voodoo religion or of anything like that. It is very much integral to the workings of everything. And I think it's everything has its roots in this particular setting and in this particular culture. And I think it grows out of that really quite beautifully.
So why should someone read Murder on the Way, do you think?
I think it is really beautifully written. I think it is a phenomenally propulsive story. You know, I think a lot of the times you pick up stuff from this era that has a very good reputation because it does one thing particularly well. And I think what this does is it does a huge amount of stuff incredibly well. There's a couple of lovely contemporary reviews. The New York Times said, "Mystery addicts with a taste for grisly new kinks will meet them abundantly here, dressed up in a style which, if at times lush and lurid, is predominantly apt and vivid." And I feel like that captures it. You know, there are so many new ideas in their presentation, and it's just this incredibly rich realization of what should be, what was by 1935, a country house murder was, you know, a fairly routine thing. And he just finds so many ways to turn it into something. He's not just the Emperor's New Clothes, like he's genuinely doing something new with it. I think it's very clever in that regard. There's a Kentucky newspaper that said, "The book is unusually well written, and the element of suspense is carried almost to an extreme, despite the slightly humorous style adopted by Theodore Roscoe. Probably it will be considered one of the best mysteries of the year, since it breaks away from the tradition of seriousness that has held that type of literature for several years, and yet loses nothing in interest and excitement." And again, I think there's that aspect to it. You know, it feels like a new and a fresh and an exciting take on what was a 15, 20-year-old trope by this point. And it, you know, even people at the time appreciated that it was something very different.
And it's nice to see it in some form as a type of comedy. There are there's a funny element running through the whole thing and the madness of it all, which... it plays with the seriousness of other stories that you could have done in the same way, and therefore lacked an authenticity because you were trying to make it too creepy or scary. Mm. The lightness of touch that he has makes it work, even though it's very grotesque.
There's kind of a sniff of the League of Gentlemen about, I think.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk about getting a classic back into print. What was the process of doing that? How did it even begin?
It began very unscientifically. Initially, it was a case of trying to track down who actually had the rights, because all of this stuff is governed by rights. Mm. And fundamentally, I was just trying to get some sense of who was legally responsible for this book. And I mean, I started off, there are several academic libraries. There's one in the US that had a lot of Roscoe's papers donated by his wife after his death. And I got in touch with them and I was like, "Do you know who holds the rights?" And they were like, "Nope, his wife donated loads of papers." Then it turned out that his wife was dead. They didn't have any children. So then you start getting into the whole, am I going to have to look up this guy's will and try to find out if he bequeathed his literary rights to any? And it, you know, I mean, there are ways to do this. It's just a question of how much effort. And I mean, I never knew it was whether it was going to be successful. Bold Venture, who have published it, were amazing. Like, once I kind of got onto them, they were absolutely incredible. But there was never any guarantee. You know, this was nearly 18 months ago that I was starting to do this. And there was no guarantee it was ever going to happen. Or I could, you know, it could still be now, as we are, December 2017, I could still be trying to make it happen. And you go, I don't want to pour hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds into something where, yeah, that's just not going to happen. But there was a sort of a bloody-minded curiosity. So I just, anywhere that I could find a meaningful mention of Roscoe, I emailed people. Trying to convince people of your bona fides is quite difficult, I think, when you are just a guy with an email address, when you're not obviously representing some legal firm or some publisher or anything like that. And it was a lot of sending emails to any library, any publisher, trying to find out what had happened to, because this was originally published by the New York Dodge Publishing Company. And I was like, right, they might have something, and then they went under in the 1960s or something. And so then you go, oh God, have I got to get into the literary rights of all of their... Like, it's, there are just so many. It almost feels like an investigation in its own right.
Absolutely. And so how did you end up working with Bold Venture then, and what were their involvement in republishing this book?
I really lucked out. I can't stress enough how much this is not how people should go about trying to publish a book. Like, I was very, very, very lucky, because there's a biography of Roscoe that was published called Pulpmaster by a lady called Audrey Prente, and I read this in the hope that there would be any hint as to what was happening with his rights or anything like that. And after reading it, and in the book itself, Audrey has interviewed Roscoe, so she knew him towards the end of his life, and they worked together on the writing of this biography. He wrote an introduction for it, very modestly kind of poo-pooing his own suitability for this kind of undertaking, considering the hundreds of thousands, probably millions of, definitely millions of words the guy wrote. And so I got in touch, I emailed Audrey, and I was like, I've read your biography of Theodore Roscoe. I am trying to see if it's possible to republish Murder on the Way. Would you have any idea, as you met the man, would you have any idea what the situation is with his rights, with the intellectual property rights to his publications? And then Audrey is one of the two CEOs of Bold Venture Press, and just pure serendipity, was completely on board for doing this, and just like very quickly was like, that's a really great idea.
Wow.
I would love to be involved. And the thing that's really nice about it as well is that because she knew him and she knew his wife, you know, she knew them towards the end of their life, but it feels like you're involved in it in a slightly more personal level. You know, this was never about me trying to make hundreds of thousands of pounds, because that's not going to happen. That was never going to happen. That's never what I was trying to do. It was mainly just trying to get something and just sort of do it justice and try to get it back in print. I mean, the work they've done, the physical paperback copy is beautiful. Like, they've got these Gustave Doré enlargements on all the blank pages that face you at the start of each chapter. And it just looks incredible. And you just feel like you've got that extra level of interest from them, because Audrey knew Roscoe so well. And like, you really felt like they were just so on board with it from the very beginning. And everything that I asked, all of my stupid questions, they were just so patient and phenomenal. And I mean, I completely lucked out. I really did. So I really cannot, again, stress how this is not how you publish a book, and just how lucky I got in terms of getting it, you know, finding Audrey as quickly as I did.
So why is it then that so many authors who were so popular, like Roscoe, who wrote so much work, and many other writers that we could talk about from the Golden Age canon, why is it that they fall into such obscurity in almost such a short period of time? And why is it so difficult to bring these writers back? And then also alongside that, you mentioned the death of Jezebel earlier. Why is it that some writers' books get this mythology around them suddenly, and you can't find a copy for less than £600, you know, or something like that?
Yeah.
Whereas some other books you can get for £2.50, you know, an old Penguin copy. Why do those things occur, do you think?
I mean, I'm no expert in this. I'm very much the neophyte in this world. But the very brief glimpse I've had, it is just, I think, the legalistic aspects of rights can be incredibly hard to track. And I think a lot of stuff probably only had one printing. Like, for instance, Whistle Up the Devil. You talk about books that enjoy this tremendous reputation. Whistle Up the Devil by Derek Smith was one such novel. Now, to my understanding, it was printed once by the Thriller Book Club in the early 1930s. It was a very small print run, and then it just disappeared from view. That was republished a couple of years ago by Locked Room International. Part of the holdup was the guy who had been bequeathed the rights to Derek Smith's works in his will was not informed by the executors of Derek Smith's will that he had been bequeathed the rights. So he didn't actually know that he had the rights. And it wasn't until an investigation of the will unearthed this that they could then, that John Pugmire, who runs Locked Room International, could then track down the relevant person and get the legal rights to do so. I think also the reason a lot of stuff goes out of print is because there were so many people writing in this school at the time, and people do just drop out of circulation. Christie, stayed in circulation because there's been a very simple handling of her rights, as well as a very visible promotion of the books through inferior television adaptations, inferior movie adaptations, inferior radio adaptations.
Inferior party box games, you know.
God, I did a party box game. Yeah, I'd forgotten that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, you're quite right. And so it's very much as well whether anybody's willing to license it. But just keeping track of the sheer number of people, I think, is also part of the difficulty. I'm sure there are some amazing books out there, and I'm sure some people read them, and then, you know, like John Norris on his Pretty Sinister blog does an amazing job at keeping stuff that is out of print, sort of, you know, bringing that back into some sort of public awareness. And I think there was the Hex murder that he reviewed a couple of years ago, and then Coachwhip Publications reprinted, I think, inspired at least partly, if not entirely, by John's sort of championing of it as a book. And it's stuff like that where there's, you know, everything that is difficult and everything that has fallen out of favour needs a champion, but whether anybody's going to be able to champion it with all of the other books there are to keep track of, and whether anybody then pays attention to it once it's championed. It's just this, it's this unholy brew of so many things. You know, I mean, someone like, the fact that Carr is out of print is, to you and me and to however many of other people are going to listen to this, an immense frustration.
Yeah.
Because of how visible he is in the genre, how important he was to the development of the genre. But there's obviously complications around the rights, whether that is an indifference on a part of the rights holders, whether that is an unawareness on a part of the rights holders, whether that is, I don't know, you know, whether someone's just being avaricious in terms of what they want from a pecuniary perspective. We just don't know. But I can definitely believe there are so many authors where the rights are not clear, or where there is just a reluctance to publish for whatever personal reasons. And I think, you know, it's a tremendous shame. I don't understand why somebody sits on rights they own and refuses to let a book be published. Because if it's a money thing, if you're not publishing the books, you're not making any money. Whatever you're offered is more than nothing you're going to make by just sitting on the rights and waiting for the publication, waiting for the statute of, not statute of limitations, whatever it's called, to expire, so that you can, you know, so it can just be published in the public domain. I don't know, the whole thing mystifies me.
Yeah, absolutely. So by way of rounding up, one question that I was thinking of a lot as I was reading Murder on the Way was the fact that as you've edited the book, proofread, got the document ready for republication and reprinting, what was that process like? Many of us will read a GAD book once, maybe twice, maybe three times if we really loved it, and being taken through the thrill of a book on its first time is so important. But what was that process like of going word by word, page by page, chapter by chapter, getting it finalised? Does that change the way you remember it, relate to it, the way you read it?
A little bit. Like, I proofread books for publishers as well,
yeah,
which that changes a certain amount of what you, of how you read a book, largely because when you then see the final published version and you see an error that still made it through, there are a very good friend of mine very kindly bought Murder on the Way and then went through and circled all of the errors, all of the stuff that I missed. And she's like, oh, they're, you know, they're about 20 or so. And I was like, okay, well, that's great, because there were approximately, you know, 8,000 when I first got the scanned documents. And that's, but it still pains me. I can't open it without turning to a page. I'm like, oh God, there's an error on there. And I think I feel that probably a bit more keenly. In terms of my relationship to this book, it's a little schizophrenic. I read it in both forms. I read Murder on the Way and I read A Grave Must Be Deep. And they are broadly very similar, but there are key differences in chronology. There are key differences in precise character actions and things like this, which even to this day, I have not quite separated. Even looking through this book in preparation for this podcast, I'm reading certain things and going, I do not remember it happening like that, which obviously is either my faulty memory just conflating it with another book entirely, or potentially something from A Grave Must Be Deep. I feel it very personally. You know, I consider myself very lucky to be able to champion this and the other Roscoe book that we published, I published with Bold Venture, which is I'll Grind Their Bones, which was published the year after this. I feel very lucky that I love them as much as I do, and I can be as genuinely enthusiastic about them as I am. And I mean it. It's not some feigned excitement because I put however many hundreds of hours of my life into this. I honestly think they are both brilliant books for their own reasons.
Any other projects on the way? Now that you've spent hours, hundreds of hours of your life getting these books out and other things and tormenting yourself, any more torture to come?
I mean, there's nothing official with any official publishers. Last year, the year before, God, I can't remember now, I sort of collaborated with Tomcat on a collection of out-of-copyright impossible crime stories and released it free through my blog called Ye Olde Book of Locked Room Conundrums. And I'd love to do another one of those. Mm. Tomcat sent me this phenomenal list of other out-of-copyright stories.
Wow.
And I live half an hour from the British Library, and there's a bit of me that would love to do a second volume of Ye Olde Book of Locked Room Conundrums and equally make that available for free through the website.
And for those of you who don't know Tomcat, he's another very avid GAD reader and blogger and blogs at the moonlightdetective.blogspot.
Yes, Beneath the Stains of Time.
Beneath the Stains of Time. Search that up. He's got some great articles and writes profusely on Locked Room mysteries and Golden Age detective fiction.
Although take some of it with a pinch of salt, because he's not a fan of Rupert Penny. So, and that's that's immediately suspicious.
Well, thank you, JJ, it's been a joy to discuss this book with you. Thanks for your openness, your honesty. And I just want to tell everyone who's listening to this now, as it comes out this date, it is right before Christmas. There is still time to order this book for your friends, family, children, pets and loved ones. Where can they get it? Where can they get Murder on the Way and I'll Grind Their Bones?
You can get both of them on all good book-selling websites. You know if it's a good book-selling website because it sells them. If it doesn't sell them, it's not a good book-selling website. These books are very much, I think, the answer to the question, what do you get the detective fiction fan who has everything? They may not have these. And if they don't, they should.
And if it's not a Christmas present for someone else, it should be a treat to yourself.
Definitely. you have earned it. You have definitely earned it.
Well, Merry Christmas to everyone, and thanks again, JJ, and we'll see you next time.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dan. Merry Christmas, everybody.